From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. While writing a memoir about his many phobias, Alan Shaun realized that a central fact of his life is that his twin sister Mary is autistic. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Shaun about his new memoir, Twin. Shaun also writes about learning that his father, William Shaun, who was the longtime editor of The New Yorker, had a long-term relationship with another woman. Alan's mother knew, but this was kept secret from Alan and his brother.
What really disturbed me was that everybody else knew about this and that it seemed like we'd grown up in a strange bubble of not knowing this very, you know, simple and basic fact of his life.
And we remember English actor Pete Postlethwaite, who died Sunday at the age of 64. His films include The Usual Suspects, In the Name of the Father, and The Town. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Shaun, has a fraternal twin sister, Mary, who is autistic. He's often wondered what her experience of the world is, what she sees, hears, and feels. Alan and Mary Shaun were very close until the age of 8, when she was institutionalized. His new memoir, Twin, is about how Mary's presence and absence affected his life. Shaun also writes about a secret that his parents kept from him. His father, William Shaun, who was the longtime editor of The New Yorker, had another woman in his life, The New Yorker writer Lillian Ross. That relationship lasted from 1954 until William Shaun's death in 1992. Alan Shaun wonders how his mother lived under the strain of having a disabled child and a partially absent husband. Alan Shaun is a composer and teaches at Bennington College. His previous memoir was about living with his many phobias, which include agoraphobia, fear of heights, fear of vast open spaces, and fear of closed spaces. Alan Shaun, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like you to do a short reading from the book just to set it up for us.
Mary disappeared from my daily life when we were 8 years old, when my parents placed her in an institution for the mentally disabled. And as a reader of my previous book will know, it took me painfully long even to recognize that the event had left a kind of ocean of disquiet in me that manifested itself in panic attacks and a lifelong struggle with agoraphobia, and in my difficulties negotiating some aspects of public life, as well as in my reactions to trivial losses. Indeed, that it was so hard for me to openly disclose my own problems was partially due to my fear of the mental illness that Mary had exhibited, and which had led, or so it had seemed to me as a child, to her being ostracized from the family. I suppose that as her twin, it was doubly hard for me to know how and where to draw the boundary line between her nature and mine, between the inherent strangeness of being a person and the kind of strangeness that led to what I saw as banishment from normal human society. Yet I wasn't aware of any of this when I was growing up. It wasn't until I reached late middle age that I could even begin to acknowledge that being Mary's twin was a central fact, perhaps the central fact of my life.
That's Alan Shaun reading from his new memoir, Twin. It must have been so confusing to be a twin and do everything together, sleep together, eat together. And then suddenly your twin is moved to another room, and then your twin is moved to an institution for the mentally disabled. Did you sense before she was taken away that something was wrong, that you were different or she was different?
Yes, I think from my earliest memories, I think I was aware of Mary as being on her own track and in a way needing to be explained, not only to my friends, but even to my parents at times. I was sometimes like a kind of a go-between between Mary and my parents, as I remember it anyway. But this was such a fact of life that, I wasn't terribly conscious of the idea that there might be another way to be a twin, or that there were families with no such issues in them.
There were things that she did that were considered very unusual. She had an obsession with her right arm. She would kiss it and smile at it, and when she was upset, she would scream unusually long and loud. She sometimes smeared the wall with feces. Did that just seem normal to you because you grew up with it?
It did. It seemed completely normal. And to be honest, I may have written this book, but I still find it very difficult to talk about as something strange. And I feel a great deal of shyness about the subject. There's a funny experience that you have when you're writing that is unique. You can say things that on print, even knowing that others are going to read them, that are very hard to talk about in person. And
it sounds like this is in part an impulse to protect your sister.
Definitely. Well, writing the book was very difficult from that point of view. I constantly was asking myself, well, what would she feel about my saying this? And yet that question is, it's not only unanswerable, it's really unaskable. I did talk to her briefly about the fact that I was writing this book, but I'll never really know if she understood what I was asking.
Yeah. When your parents realized that Mary had a disorder, they moved her to a different room. Then they moved her to an institution. And you say your parents started to try to protect you from her, encourage you to think of yourself as simply an individual as opposed to a twin. How did being an individual feel different from being a twin?
I don't think I've ever felt like an individual the way a non-twin does. And I haven't taken a survey of twins, of course, but I literally feel like a bookend, you know, as if there were a set of books next to me, and at the other end of those books, there was another bookend. I have a sense of being part of a pair of things. And even in relation to Wally, my brother, I feel some sense that he's an individual, but that I am part of something.
What did your parents tell you when they sent Mary away?
Well, it happened in stages. The first stage was that she went to a summer camp for children with mental disabilities. And so we were told that she was going to this camp. And certainly the impression was that she was doing very well there and very happy, and far happier than she'd been in New York City. And the next stage was that my parents said that Mary would be staying there.
What is your twin sister's official diagnosis?
Well, today she's diagnosed as autistic, and it still says she suffers from schizoaffective disorder on her diagnosis, although I'm not convinced myself that that's accurate. And she's mentally retarded as well. It's possible to be autistic, as you know, and be very high functioning. And she's in some ways like a third grader or a second grader in terms of her reading skills, for example. She's very good at certain mathematical operations. Other things mean nothing to her, but certain things she's far better than I am, that's for sure.
When your sister was first diagnosed, it was a time when parents were often blamed for their child's autism, that it was something the parents did wrong. Did this happen to your parents?
Well, obviously we weren't sitting around discussing this. As you know from the book, we barely touched on the subject. I certainly remember soaking up the idea that maybe Mary could be cured of her problems. There was a tremendous amount of fantasy about Mary in the family, and at least it seems like fantasy now. I used to wonder if she was pretending to not be well. I still feel that there is a kind of intelligence in her that simply is on a different wavelength from mine or yours, and that we just don't have the right receiving instruments to decode what she's thinking and to comprehend her kind of intelligence. But certainly a fantasy was that she could be cured, and that would imply that there was a cause in the world for what was ailing her, which suggests that on some level I wondered if I or my parents had harmed her in some way and made her withdraw into herself. This thought was certainly not just a fantasy because at that time, most parents of autistic children were told by their pediatricians that it was probably the result of coldness on the part of the mother. And it's an appalling thing to think that parents in that era were first saddled with the unimaginably difficult task of trying to raise a child who is just not responding to them, and secondly, being told that it's something they're doing that has caused this, even though they may have other children who are relatively okay.
And you're talking about the 1950s and the early 1960s.
Yes, we were born in 1948, so we're talking about the 50s, early 60s.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the composer and music professor Alan Shawn, who has written a new memoir called Twin, and it's about being the brother of a twin sister who is autistic and at the age of 8 was sent away to an institution. Alan Shawn's father is William Shawn, the late editor of the New Yorker magazine, and his brother is Wallace Shawn, the writer and an actor. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Shawn. He's a composer and music professor at Bennington College, and he's the author of a previous memoir that was about his phobias. His new memoir, Twin, is about being the brother of a twin sister who, at the age of 8, was sent away to an institution because she's autistic. Now, you later learned that there was another big problem in your family, which is that your father was having an affair with Lillian Ross, a writer at The New Yorker, and this is when he was editor of that magazine. And this lasted until your father's death. And he'd have dinner with your mother every night and spend the night at home, but he'd also spend time most days at Lillian Ross's home, or at least with her, wherever they were. And I'm right. thinking, like, what a strain this must have been on the family to, on the one hand, have an autistic daughter who is sent to a special institution, and on the other hand, to have your father having such a long-term affair. It lasted till the end of his life. It started in 1954 and lasted till the end of his life.
Right. I didn't, in fact, know about this relationship until I was close to 30 years old. And I certainly didn't know Lillian's name or anything in detail at all about the relationship. And I heard about it only by chance, in fact.
By chance, not by from your father, but from somebody else.
No. In fact, to call it an affair when it lasted such a long time, it's a funny word. We don't really have language for these things, do we?
No, it's almost like a parallel marriage.
It is. I mean, there's so much one never knows about a marriage. My own memory of my parents as a married couple would certainly surprise any listeners who are would expect to see a dead finished marriage that's sort of just progressing in a pro forma way, and they're imagining that my father's real life was elsewhere. I mean, obviously, he loved both women. Well, perhaps it isn't obvious, because, as I say, we don't have language for these things. The extent to which he loved our mother can hardly be overstated, and he expressed it in hundreds and hundreds of little notes that he left her, an incredibly beautiful poem he wrote on their anniversary in the last 15 years, anyway, of his life.
During an early evaluation of your sister at one of the institutions that she was in, the doctor wrote, "Father is a rather short, very anxious man who is editor of the New Yorker magazine. Mother is also a very anxious woman. Both parents seemed reluctant to convey any information about the nature of their anxiety or its cause. I have the sense of some sort of mutual protective alliance underway. I could not discern the basis for this or be sure who was protecting whom." You know, I read that and I thought, were they kind of unknowingly in this kind of protective relationship, and the doctor picked up on it, and what the doctor was picking up on was this secret relationship that your father had.
Well, they were born secretive. I mean, they were secretive about so many things, including my father's own phobias, the difficulty he had getting to that institution, for example. The fact that they were both seeing psychiatrists. Nobody ever knew that, or at least very few people knew it. I certainly didn't know it. My mother used to say quite often about many different things, "Now, don't mention that. Don't mention this." Our Jewishness was not actually denied, but it was very much soft-pedaled. When I started having my problems with phobias, my parents said, well, just don't tell anybody about it. So there was a lot of secrecy, so I don't think it was only his what people called double life by any means that they were concealing. I think they had a very strong sense of privacy. I have it myself, and I'm sure Wally does too.
Well, you're not helping with the memoir.
Yes, it's a funny thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but I'm thinking about the burden it must have been to carry around so many secrets. I mean, like, don't tell people about your sister. Don't tell people about your father's phobias. Don't let on you're really Jewish. Don't tell people about your own phobias. And you probably sensed that there was a secret that your father was keeping, even though you didn't know it was there.
You know, people have asked me that, and it sounds like it must be true, but it was a very complicated household, it's very much like a late 19th century, early 20th century, you know, Viennese household. It feels like I'm remembering something that happened at least a century ago or more. It was very, very complicated. There were lots of little hidden rules, and the rules were not explicit very often. In fact, sometimes the rules themselves were secret. If you pointed out that certain things, well, for example, you mentioned that my father was short. Well, we were all short, and those of us who are alive are still short. And I remember once saying that we were short. And that elicited an hour-long debate and discussion. And believe me, there was no doubt about it.
Do you think your parents did the right thing in sending your twin, who is autistic, to an institution?
Well, the options available to them at that time were very, very few. Obviously I've asked myself this question, and some people have already written me and asked me, whether I think this was barbaric and so on. Mary was a very, very unhappy child. There were very few people who could understand how to comfort her, how to soothe her. She would run through the corridors of the house, screaming and holding her ears as if her own screams frightened her. Sometimes she would be peaceful and she would look very contented. Sometimes she would be very absorbed in things. But quite often she was very, very unhappy. Mary was an outsider at schools for the so-called normal. There really was no place for her to go to school with her peers. Then they found a place in a beautiful part of Cape Cod, Chatham, Massachusetts, on the water. There was a routine there that was fun. There were kids there that Mary played with. She had her first real friends. She seemed happier. She looked happier. And as I say, there wasn't that much understanding of the kind of condition that Mary had. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I think given the options they had, they made the decision that, you know, good people would make, you know, under those circumstances.
Alan Shaun will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called Twin. Shaun is a composer and pianist. Here he is performing one of his compositions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the British actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died yesterday at the age of 64. His movies include In the Name of the Father, The Usual Suspects, and The Town. Also, Alan Shaun tells us why he couldn't tell his mother that he knew about his father's affair, even though she'd known about it for years. We're listening to Alan Shaun playing one of his compositions. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alan Shaun. His new memoir, Twin, is about how it's affected his life to have a twin sister, Mary, who is autistic. The memoir is also about growing up the son of William Shaun, who was the long-term editor of The New Yorker. Alan Shaun is a composer and teaches at Bennington College. In trying to understand the mental state of your sister, you say that you think that maybe when you're composing and you're kind of in a composing trance, it may be the closest thing that you experience to what Mary, your sister, experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Outside of other things that you think are close, like when you're sick or exhausted.
Right. So, well, yeah, in writing this book, I was realizing more and more the degree to which I could identify with her. And one of the ways I can identify is in the isolation that she experiences. And when I'm writing music, I'm in my own little world. And I guess I like to think of that, after writing this book anyway, as my own kind of autistic state.
Why do you think of composing as being similar to being in an autistic state?
I think one of the characteristics of Mary and people like Mary is a quality of absorption in small things, and a lack of social connectedness. And although I'm reasonably sociable, not as sociable as I'd like to be, but when I'm composing, I'm really deeply alone, and it's just me and these notes on the page and these sounds in the air, and that quality of absorption reminds me of the way Mary used to look when she would be studying plastic necklace on the floor at the age of 5 and just getting lost in the way the beads connected to each other. So I guess I'm theorizing that we all have an autistic side.
What's your twin sister Mary like now as a woman in her 60s?
She has a very different quality when you're with her than she does if you're trying to talk to her on the phone. I spoke to her a couple of days ago, and I was thinking about that. She's not someone who's going to originate thoughts and perceptions or ideas or make comments on the phone. She'll be most likely to just answer your questions with either the most routine answer or even a repetition of the question. But when you're with her, she's intense. She looks at you. She's full of personality. She's full of humor. There's a kind of vibrating, passionate quality to her. As I say, it's almost as if she's repressing all kinds of perceptions of the world that she can't articulate in the way we're used to things being articulated. But you can't expect the give and take with her, even in person, that you can normally with people.
For you, being a twin and knowing that your twin sister is autistic and that she was taken away from you because of that and sent to an institution, this is a formative experience in your life. This is one of the basic building blocks of who you are emotionally and mentally. But do you have any sense of how much knowledge your twin has of you as being her twin, as somebody who she was once very, very connected with and then at the age of 8 separated from?
I really don't. She certainly asks after Wally as much as she asks after me. And all I can say is that when we're together, she looks very, very pleased. She immediately takes my hand, and the connection is instantaneous. I wouldn't differentiate it, though, from the connection she feels for Wally or that she felt for her parents. I don't think the concept of twin means anything, but I think certain memories are ineradicable in her. You know, the passage of time doesn't mean a thing. So she must carry within her some sense of intense familiarity with me. That's all I can say for sure.
I think about what an extraordinary family that you're from. Your father being William Shawn, the former editor of The New Yorker, your brother Wally Shawn, an actor and playwright, you being a composer and music professor, your sister autistic, you and your father both sharing a lot of phobias, and also your father having this huge secret that he was having an affair for most of his marriage from 1954 till his death in the 80s with Lillian Ross. It's such a mix of kind of like talent and secrecy and phobia and eccentricity. And so, I know you found that kind of accidentally when you were 30 that your father was having an affair. I know you kept it from your mother until your father got sick.
Right.
What happened after you found out from somebody else who had a little bit too much to drink that your father was having this affair? Did you tell your father that you knew? Like, what happened after that?
Well, at that point, I wasn't sure if I believed this. And, of course, it wasn't described as an affair so much as a way of life. I think the thing that disturbed me the most, to be honest, this may offend some listeners, what really disturbed me was that everybody else knew about this and that it seemed like we'd grown up in a strange bubble of not knowing this very, you know, simple and basic fact of his life. I can see now how it happened. But rather than think, what a terrible thing he did, I thought how terrible it was that both my parents thought it was fine that we would just find out 40 years later by chance, maybe when we couldn't even discuss it with them. So at that point, I was very eager to talk to him about it, and we did have some wonderful long talks about it.
He told your mother knew, your mother decided that she was willing to live that way, and they both kept the secret from you and your brother Wally.
That's right, and I think it was something she never came to terms with and never accepted. But the one thing she couldn't tolerate was its being discussed with us, with the boys, as we were called at that point.
So when you told your father that you knew, he told you not to tell your mother that you knew?
Yes.
That must have been so hard to do. I mean, we were talking about keeping secrets in a family, but like to know that she knew and then to know yourself and yet not to be able to acknowledge to her that you knew and that you knew that she knew. I mean, what a huge secret.
Right. Well, one of the ironies of this is that a constraint of that kind really interferes with having a good, loving relationship. So,
It forces you to lie. It forces you to both lie.
Yes. And to see her lying and to know she's lying and it's a circular thing. The sad thing is that it wasn't until she and I talked about this that I felt as close to her as I really would have all along. It was a barrier. I hadn't known there was a barrier to a full understanding of my father's life. But I was highly conscious of the fact that there was this barrier between me and my mother after I knew this.
When she started opening up to you, did you get a sense of what was in it for her to live in a relationship where your father had a lifelong relationship with another woman at the same time? She was willing to accept that. So what was in it for her on her end of accepting that as opposed to what a lot of women would do, which is give an ultimatum, like you can't be married to two people, so choose her or choose me. You can't live with both.
Well, obviously, they all decided at some point that you can't be married to two people. I think it wasn't that she accepted it. She accepted him. She deeply loved him, and their relationship was still alive. It certainly wasn't a matter of just convenience that they stayed together. But also, for his part, I think that this kind of duality was something in him. He was incapable of making a choice either. And one way of looking at it is perhaps this was also necessary for their marriage. As I say, there's a lot you don't know about any marriage. Because perhaps it was even more alive than it would have been otherwise. That's possible. When I think back to the atmosphere at home, yes, there were mysteries, but there was also love and romance in the air.
Seeing your parents' unusual relationship and watching them parent you and your brother as well as your autistic sister, did that make you any more enthusiastic or reluctant to enter into a marriage yourself and to become a father? Were you afraid if you became a father that your child would have developmental problems? Were you afraid if you became a husband that you'd have to have two marriages instead of one? I mean, you were exposed to such extremes in your own family.
Well, I probably should have been afraid. but I entered into my first marriage and parenthood of my first two children very unaware of how burdened I was by all of these issues. But I think the net effect of all of that was to make me feel quite strongly about family and to want to be a parent. So you're going to have to figure that one out, Terry. But I think that's the effect it had on me.
Okay. Alan Shawn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alan Shawn's new memoir is called Twin. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the British actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died yesterday at the age of 64. His movies include In the Name of the Father, The Usual Suspects, Amistad, and The Town. This is Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to an interview with the British actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died of cancer yesterday at the age of 64. Americans came to know Postlethwaite through the 1993 movie In the Name of the Father, for which he earned an Oscar nomination. In 94, he co-starred in The Usual Suspects, playing a mysterious and sinister character named Kobayashi. Steven Spielberg called him probably the best actor in the world after directing him in Amistad and The Lost World, Jurassic Park. His recent films include Inception and The Town. Postlethwaite had a face that made an impression on you. An AP article described it as remarkably craggy and time-worn. One critic described his cheekbones as boiling out of his head like swollen knuckles. His voice made an impression, too. He could play very vulnerable or very tough, as in this scene with Ben Affleck from Affleck's film The Town. Postlethwaite played a crime boss in a working-class neighborhood. Affleck worked for him pulling heists. When Affleck tells Postlethwaite he wants out, Postlethwaite threatens him and tells him how he ruined the life of Affleck's father.
Play the horses? You know, they either geld a horse with a knife or with the chemicals. And your daddy said no to me. I did him the chemical way. Gave your mother a taste. Put the hook into her. Now she doped up good and proper. Hung herself with a wire on Melnair Cass. And you, run around the neighborhood looking for her. Your daddy didn't have the heart to tell his son that he was looking for a suicide doper who was never coming home. If there's a heaven, son, she ain't in it.
Pete Postlethwaite in a scene from last year's movie, The Town. I spoke with Postlethwaite in 1997. You're from a working-class family, I believe, in the north of England. Mm-hmm. How were you exposed to acting? Was it mostly through movies, or did you actually see a lot of theatre where you lived?
No, I didn't see a lot of theatre to start with. I suppose it was pictures, really. Saturday morning cinema and things like that. We used to go and see Tom Mix and Hopalong Cassidy and things like that. But I suppose in terms, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's something to do with the Catholic background. You know, being an altar boy, you know, being on that altar, you know, it's a bit like being on stage, you know. Maybe there's something in that. I don't know. And then at grammar school, I started to do a couple of plays. We did The Importance of Being Earnest, I remember, and did A Man for All Seasons. Quite enjoyed that, doing those kind of things. Then I went to college and read drama and PE, a strange mixture, physical education and drama. And drama eventually took over. It was at the time, the late 60s, when there was some extraordinary writing coming out of England. Plays by Pinter and Beckett and all these guys were all writing these extraordinary plays, like Waiting for Godot and Look Back in Anger and stuff like that, all happening at the same time. And I thought, blimey, this is extraordinary stuff. So I really enjoyed all that, but then thought, well, you still can't go and be an actor. I mean, people from Warrington don't go and be actors, really. So I decided to carry on. I'd teach for a couple of years and then see what happened after that. And if I still fancied it after that, I'd go and do it.
So you taught physical education?
No, I taught in the first year, actually, when I left. I taught, really, it was hardly teaching. It was in what we call an approved school in England, which is for naughty kids, really. It's for children who have find it very difficult to fit into the system and rebel against it. And that generally the schools can't cope with them, so they send them to approved schools, which they were then. So that was more like social work than teaching, even though I was, employed as a teacher. And I did that for a year and then went to a girls' convent grammar school, would you believe, in Manchester, and taught 1,000 girls a week. Drama, that was. I was a member of the English department to start with, an English teacher. On the staff, and the staff was massive. There's 77 on this staff. It's a big school. And I realised there wasn't a drama department, so I thought, well, I'll create a drama department and then I can be head of it, really. So that's what basically I did. So I taught drama there. But then even after that, after a year of that, I thought, still not really what I want to do. So I went back to school. I applied back to drama school and went back to basics at the Bristol Old Vic, and left there in 1970, and now find myself in a studio in New York talking to you about it in 1997.
What did your parents say when you left teaching? Did they think you were being unrealistic?
Yes, they did, yeah. It took about 10 or 11 years before my mum stopped saying, well, eventually you'll get a proper job. And I think that basically came as well. These sound terrible stories against my mother, and they're not meant to be, but I think she realised the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is a massive, wonderful company in England, or can be wonderful. They can also do some awful stuff now and again. But we opened a new theatre there, the Swan Theatre, and Queen Elizabeth, our queen, came to open it. And my mother, who's my queen, I suppose, came as well to watch it. And when she saw me being introduced to the Queen on the stage of the Royal Shakespeare Company, I think then she thought, well, no, yes, it's a serious job now. That's all right. That's perfectly all right for him to do. But it was strange. Yeah, I think they did. They did think, oh, well, he'll grow out of that or whatever. It was a strange choice for somebody from my background.
You really made your mark in America with the movie In the Name of the Father, in which you played the father of a young man who's unjustly accused of an IRA bombing of a British pub. Mm-hmm. And the son's family is held as co-conspirators. So mm-hmm. you are imprisoned with your son, played by yep. Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm-hmm. And it's a great role. You know, you start off in the movie looking like a real spineless guy, you know, a father who'd never stand up for himself or for his son or for anybody. Someone who'd let people walk over him. But in the jail scenes, you show this surprising inner strength, and watching the dynamics change between the father and the son in jail are just a really fascinating, very subtle performance. Tell me your take on this character, what your profile of him was when you were figuring out how you should perform in the role.
Well, he was my dad, really. He was exactly my dad. Who died in 1988, who was northern working class Catholic. But there is a breed of these people that have this extraordinary inner strength. They appear to be spineless, they appear to be easy meat, but in fact when the pressure is on, they resort to their inner strength, this resilience that they have, which is based on their values and their beliefs and what they think. And my dad and Giuseppe were very similar, except Giuseppe was Northern Irish, whereas my father was Northern English. But there's exactly the same kind of background. And there's a whole breed of these kind of men and women. And that's the kind of profile you get. You think, well, you've got to do justice to these people.
We're listening back to an interview with actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died yesterday at the age of 64. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with British actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died of cancer yesterday at the age of 64. When we left off, we were talking about his film In the Name of the Father.
Now, you played a very different kind of character in an earlier movie called Distant Voices, Still Lives. And in this movie, you're an abusive father.
Horrendous.
And husband. And I know when I saw the movie, every time you appeared on screen, my whole body would tighten. I mean, it's like, here it comes again. So it's interesting how you were able to embody two such different kinds of fathers and husbands. And I wonder what the difference is in how you carried your own body, how you presented your own self physically in both roles, and In the Name of the Father and Distant Voices, Still Lives.
I never thought about it like that, really. But looking at it now, you're obviously right. Yeah, there was a difference. Strange, really, because maybe the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives was inherently weak, whether it was because of his lack of employment or his migraine or his drinking problem, I don't know, but he was inherently weak, whereas, in a way, Giuseppe Conlon was inherently strong and outwardly weak. I mean, he was ill, whereas the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives wasn't. And it's strange that I don't identify that father with my father, isn't it? But I don't. I mean, he wasn't like that.
Good.
Yes. But that was actually very autobiographical. That was Terence Davis' film, yeah?
Yes.
Directed by Terence Davis. It was completely autobiographical, I believe. Well, I know, because that's what he said. That's what he used to do. That's what it was like. And I don't know whether
Would he critique your performance by saying, no, my father was more like this?
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. Oh, no, he would do that, yeah. I remember one particular scene where I think the daughter, we're in the cellar, cleaning up the cellar, I think, and the daughter asked for some money to go to a dance. And I think I hit her with a brush, with a yard brush. And I sort of whacked her a couple of times with the brush. And Terry said, no, he didn't do it like that. And he got hold of this brush and he turned it the other way round where the end of the broom was. And we had this metal cage around the camera. So that the brush wax would go directly into the camera. And he bent this metal with this brush. I said, oh, Terry, come on, don't be silly. No father could do that to a nobody would do that to a child. He said, no, that's what he did. That's what he did. I said, no. Do you mean that that's how it appeared to your sister as a child? I mean, with this massive thing coming out. No, he said, that's how hard he hit. I said, well, he'd kill her. And he said, no, he didn't. He didn't kill her, and that's what he did. And you just think, blimey, where do you go from there? So I don't know. I mean, he had a lot to feel angry about his father about.
Oh, I have one last question for you.
Go on.
Now, I understand when you were co-starring on Broadway in Cyrano de Bergerac, that Derek Jacobi, who played Cyrano, tossed his nose to you at the curtain call of the last performance.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, well, that must have been quite
absolutely
an honor.
True. I still have it. I still have it in a little tin box at home. It's still there.
Did you know that was coming?
No, not really. No, I didn't know. You making sort of references to kind of, you know, catching the bouquet of the... when the bride throws her bouquet and I'm the bridesmaid. No, that did happen. That did happen on the last night. Terrific last night in New York. Wonderful.
And so where's the nose being stored now?
It's in a little tin on the shelf and with all my other little memorabilia that are about mainly from films as well as plays, but I even have the rosette that was on my right shoe from that show now. Lots of little things, keepsakes, lots of little memories. They're all good. They all remind.
What other memorabilia have you kept from your shows and movies?
Well, I have the baton from Breast Off. I have the belt that I wore as Roland Tembo. I have the plaque from the coffin of Giuseppe Conlon. I have the rosette I wore on my shoe for Cyrano de Bergerac, the nose-catching incident one. I have lots of things. There's always something. You always take a little bit back, I think, just to say, well, that's mine.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem.
Pete Postlethwaite died of cancer yesterday. He was 64. Our interview was recorded in 1997. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the CIA penetrated the nuclear trafficking network of A.Q. Khan and waited too long to shut it down. Journalist Douglas Fran says the CIA was so obsessed with getting information that it stood by while Khan and his confederates spread dangerous nuclear technology around the globe. Franz co-wrote the new book, Fallout. Join us.